We see these beautiful pictures at night from the decks of these two U.S. Navy vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean. I am tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen, "I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons."
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil.
We're going to fly right through it. We flew B-1 bombers through it. We got to make it clear they must play by the rules.
Yes or no, do you think that massacre was a fabulous achievement that happened under our watch?
That is a ridiculous question. And
yes or no?
No.
Occasionally, it might be a good idea to be honest about American foreign policy.
The U.S. government spends nearly $1 trillion on defense annually, more than the next 8 countries combined. This spending fuels a military-industrial complex with a network of nearly 800 bases around the globe, while employing millions of workers domestically. Accounting for more than 15% of the entire US federal budget, military spending forms a key part of the US economy. In spite of this, it is a subject that has traditionally been all but taboo in the American political discourse. In this first episode of Our Voices special series on the US election, myself, Freddie Stewart, and North America editor, Aaron White, explore the influence of the military-industrial complex on the US economy and foreign policy.
Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
That was Dwight D. Eisenhower in his 1961 farewell address, warning of what he coined a growing military-industrial complex. The intimate connection between private contractors, the Defense Department, academic institutions, mainstream media, the culture industry, and established politicians, which has been deeply embedded within the U.S. economy since World War II. Tejasvi Nagaraja, an historian currently based at the New School in New York, tells us more.
This nexus where military leaders, national security agencies, as well as think tanks and advocates, corporations that have those contracts for procurement, as well as members of Congress, sort of reproduce that defense budget. So we have a defense budget, especially has gone up under President Trump, of over $700 billion. And that is embedded in thousands of counties across the United States, as well as the world. And so very deliberately, from the earliest decades of the 40s and 50s, they made sure that large businesses, small businesses, and working class people and middle class people are bound up in that.
It is estimated that the U.S. Armed Forces is made up of 1.4 million active personnel. Yet this does not account for those who are employed directly by private contractors, such as supply chain industries like manufacturing and big tech. To get a sense of the scale of the armaments industry, 10% of all factory input in the U.S. goes to weapons sold to the Defense Department. With the drive towards privatization and the influence of corporate lobbying, large portions of the security apparatus have been outsourced to corporate contractors. According to the Pentagon, its service contractor workforce stands at over 641,000 people. And as prominent whistleblowers such as Edward Snowden have exposed, these private contractors are pervasive beyond the hard power military budget, extending throughout the inconspicuous agencies within the national security state, such as the CIA and NSA. As Snowden explains in an interview with Democracy Now!, these security agencies have implemented a hard hiring cap independent of the federal budget, which has effectively led to a system of a hybrid private employment within the national security state.
So over the years, over the decades that have really arisen out of the post-World War II era, we have in the government created a kind of new system, a runaround for this where they go, well, all of this extra money that we want to put in people but we can't bring on as formal government employees, what if we give that money to private companies? And the private companies lease us people that in all meaningful ways are government employees. They work in government facilities, as I did as a contractor. You're at an NSA desk working on an NSA system. You're taking direction from an NSA government supervisor working on government processes. But formally, legally, you work for Dell or Lockheed Martin or a Booz Allen Hamilton or any one of these really thousands and thousands of private companies.
Even companies that many regard as distinct from the state and military apparatus actually provide essential services and infrastructure for the Defense Department. Big tech firms such as Amazon provide substantial cloud services, and Microsoft, which recently won a $10 billion 10-year contract with the Defense Department for their joint enterprise defense infrastructure. Academic institutions play a pivotal role in developing technology for the military apparatus. Johns Hopkins, for example, was awarded a $98 million contract by the Defense Department in 2016 for engineering development and research capabilities.
Since Eisenhower warned of the effects of this complex in 1961, the U.S. has been embroiled in a number of expensive and controversial foreign policy interventions. During the Cold War, the U.S. began to intervene both publicly and covertly in regions all over the world, from Vietnam to backing coups in Latin America and the Middle East. This institutionalized what Naomi Klein has called the shock doctrine, the instigation of regime change for the benefit of disaster capitalists.
I'm talking about those particular economic holdings that increase, you know, whose fortunes increase when things go bad, right? So oil and gas, you know, the bad things happen, the price of oil goes up. You know, this we know, right? Whether it is a hurricane, whether it's a war, whether it's a fear of a war, whether it's Chavez and Ahmadinejad hugging, whatever it is, bad, price of oil goes up, right? And the same is true for defense stocks. The same is true of Homeland Security stocks. The same is true for drug companies that are in the business of pandemics. So this is how I'm defining broadly the disaster capitalism complex, which is bigger than the military-industrial complex. The reason why Eisenhower warned, gave that famous warning in his last presidential address about the danger of the military-industrial complex is precisely because this is an industry that has an economic incentive for war.
Following 9/11 and the largely bipartisan support for increased domestic surveillance and the authorization of interventionism abroad, the US military-industrial economy entered its most recent iteration, the War on Terror.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world by seeking weapons of mass destruction.
During the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, the Bush administration utilized terror rhetoric as the political justification for a vast expansion of US militarism, and with it, the role of private contractors. From mercenary armies like Blackwater, founded by individuals such as Eric Prince, to a comprehensive domestic surveillance program to collect data on US citizens. Bush also legitimized the use of torture under the euphemism of enhanced interrogation, which took place in unidentified black sites around the world. In the 2008 presidential campaign, Barack Obama ran on a platform of change.
It's been a long time coming, but tonight, because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
Obama's campaign spoke out against the war in Iraq, promised to close Guantanamo Bay, and looked to downgrade the US military presence abroad. Yet in office, his administration fundamentally failed to break with the legacy of Bush's war on terror. A key example of this is the failure of his administration to prosecute the main architects of the Black Site torture program, such as Gina Haspel. In many ways, the Obama presidency actually expanded the military complex. A prime example of this is the administration's increasing use of drones. Activist, writer, and human rights attorney Nora Erekat explains further.
It was the Obama administration that increased and institutionalized the use of drones and what they regard as targeted killings throughout not just the Middle East, but Pakistan, Afghanistan, Somalia, the Philippines. We are talking about a full-out expansion of drone warfare under the euphemisms of surgical strikes and targeted assassinations, which give the impression that somehow this is cleaner and better and more humane than other forms of warfare, when in fact, all it does is creates that impression, but is killing a tremendous amount of civilian casualties, is also targeting U.S. citizens without due process. Now, the context for the Obama administration's adoption of the of drone warfare happens right after the Bush administration introduces it. But the Obama administration in its first year, in its first 2 years, initiated more drone attacks than the Bush administration had in 8 years total.
Both the failure to confront the legacy of U.S. torture and the expansion of drone warfare demonstrate a broader lack of democratic accountability within the Obama administration. Michael Brooks, host of The Michael Brooks Show, tells us more.
Barack Obama obviously campaigned in some ways clearly in a different way than he governed. And he was pretty strong when he was campaigning about closing Guantanamo and ending torture and so on. And I think, frankly, part of what happened to Obama is that on certain things, he was just boxed in by the national security state, and he didn't have a team behind him or an ideological framework behind him to fight them. And if you read some of these accounts, when he first sits down and gets these CIA briefings, they have a very specific strategy of how they're going to manipulate him. And it's no, I mean, you know, anybody could be as individually as smart as they are and whatever. The guy's at the end of the day, like a 40-something relative political newcomer who's dealing with people who's basically, I mean, they're just trained manipulators and spin artists. That's what they do. So he codifies a lot of these things. He makes things like the drone program regimented and bureaucratized. And what's interesting is that so much of it is actually predicated on, for all of the intellectualism and quote unquote smartness of it, so much of it, because it's not democratically accountable and because it is basically an illegal robot war across the globe, is actually predicated on the idea that, and this same goes for NSA surveillance, that, well, but you can trust President Obama. And even if you accepted that argument as a substitute for any type of institutional understanding, well, okay, what happens after President Obama?
Obama set the precedent that normalized this excessive use of executive power for future administrations. This normalization is aided by the complicity of established mainstream media, which often utilizes an exceptionalist discourse to legitimize and glorify the use of military technology. Here's Brian Williams, a commentator for MSNBC, extolling the recent airstrikes against Syria.
We see these beautiful pictures at night from the decks of these two U.S. Navy vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean. I am tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen, "I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons." And they are beautiful pictures of fearsome armaments making what is for them a brief flight over to this airfield.
Whilst the U.S. military has more than 800 bases around the world, the domestic mainstream media pays little attention to international news, even those that directly relate to U.S. foreign policy. And even when certain stories do make the headlines, the voices from those communities most directly impacted are often overlooked. The recent negotiations between the Trump administration and the Israeli government is a prime example. Taking lines directly from the White House, the mainstream media referred to the proposals as an Israel peace plan, typically without any critical analysis of the facts. Here's Nora Erekat.
The fact that the Trump administration, when it appears with only with Netanyahu and members of the pro-Israel lobby to reveal what they call the deal of the century, the fact that the media is not just, you know, running editorial headlines and news coverage that decries this as an imposition on the Palestinians, that's absolutely unacceptable, but instead frames it as a peace process, contemplates it, wonders what the next steps are going to be, right? It is just the greatest evidence of how bereft, you know, and the media is of playing a kind of critical role in this issue. In fact, how it's part of the problem.
By not featuring the voices of those most affected by U.S. foreign policy decisions, the mainstream media fuels the exceptionist logic of U.S. supremacy. Politicians in D.C. often follow this narrative to accrue political capital. Lobbyists from industries profiting from the military-industrial complex have tremendous influence within Washington, which is further exaggerated by the revolving door that sees politicians leave office only to be offered lucrative lobbying or public speaking roles for private institutions. Betsy Sweet, a Democratic primary candidate running for the Senate in Maine, explains the political ramifications of engaging with key foreign policy decisions.
I think that Congress, and particularly the Senate, but all of Congress, has basically given up their authority and their participation in foreign policy since 9/11, with the authorization of the use of military force bill that came in right after 9/11. So basically giving the president, this president and any president, Obama too, the right, the ability to go into armed conflict without the approval of Congress is a huge mistake. And I think they need to immediately do that and reassert the War Powers Act that gives Congress its rightful role back in this. Now, one thing that I think is very disturbing and speaks a lot to how our system is so broken is when these things have been tried recently, many legislators, many congresspeople, many senators actually don't want that power back because they think it's politically untenable. They don't want to have to vote on armed conflict, whether or not to engage in war or not, because they're worried about the political fallout. And to me, that is a Senate without a spine, and that is a Senate without the good of the globe and the country in mind.
Both inside and outside of Washington, this exceptionalist consensus is beginning to shift. From the invasion of Iraq to the war in Afghanistan, where troops have now been on the ground for over 19 years, the general public are becoming more skeptical about military intervention abroad. This has created openings in both the Democratic and Republican Party for a critique of U.S. imperialism. For example, following the Trump administration's assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, polling indicated that 63% of Republicans and 89% of Democrats disapproved of the strike. Trump himself utilized the public's anti-interventionist reticence in the 2016 general election by frequently returning to Hillary Clinton's support for the Iraq War. Yet beyond Trump's isolationist rhetoric, we've seen the rise of social movements that have demonstrated a genuine departure from the Washington consensus. Following the killings of unarmed black men by police forces all over the country, the Black Lives Matter movement took center stage during the Obama administration. The protests in Ferguson, Missouri, which followed the police shooting of an unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown, marked a substantial turning point both within the Black Lives Matter movement, but also in demonstrating how militarism abroad has led to draconian securitization at home.
Well, now a broad coalition associated with Black Lives Matter movement has released a platform of its own, demanding reparations and an end to the wars against black people. The list of demands from the Movement for Black Lives platform also includes the abolition of the death penalty, legislation to recognize the impacts of slavery, as well as investments in education initiatives, mental health services, and employment programs. The publication comes just a week before the second anniversary of the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, which sparked months of protests and catalyzed a national conversation about police killings of unarmed African-American men.
Both the war on drugs and the war on terror have led to local police forces all around the country looking increasingly like military forces abroad, with full-scale battlefield hardware. This technology, pioneered against brown and black communities abroad, is being used on these communities domestically. Local police forces all around the nation have been stockpiling drones, tanks, helicopters, many designed and used in wars in the Middle East. These tanks in Ferguson were given to the local police forces by the Pentagon, previously used in Iraq. A prominent iteration of this domestic militarism has been the role of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE, which started gathering up families under the Obama administration, and whose role has been exacerbated under the Trump administration in kicking out so-called illegal aliens. This militarization by local police has come to light during nearly every major political mobilization within the last decade, from Occupy Wall Street, the protests in Ferguson, Missouri, to the fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline. This militarized domestic policing has triggered a growing hostility to the military-industrial complex more broadly. As Tejasvi Nagaraja explains, the movement for Black Lives and the fight over the Keystone Access Pipeline is not only calling for justice for Black and Brown communities at home, but critiquing U.S. militarism.
We had this new sort of upsurge in the popular imagination of youth-led Native American sovereignty movements coming up against the Dakota Access Pipeline, as well as the Keystone Pipeline, and facing a very repressive response. And this is these are pipelines that are prepared by the Army Corps of Engineers and are bound up with big fossil fuel companies. And it's a really important education for people, right, to see the militarism and the military-industrial complex as it affects us, even in the continental United States. And we can use that to project a wider solidarity towards Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia. The Black Lives Matter movement in this Ferguson and Baltimore flashpoint moment, where there's a discussion about the way that excess military surplus equipment is supplied to local police departments in the United States, and you have this sort of imagination of tanks and flash grenades being used in the streets against poor Black Americans in Ferguson, Missouri. And that sort of vision and that sort of sense of solidarity. So activists in Ferguson, youth activists, talk about how, you know, they went on social media and they got solidarity from Palestinian young people saying, you know, this is how you deal with tear gas. This is how you deal with these forms of repression. It's very important for creating a sense of popular solidarity. And even as we root for these progressive politicians, that sense of people-to-people solidarity will continue to be important.
These movements have propelled a new wave of insurgent politicians who are willing to criticize the U.S. military complex. Importantly, many of these politicians are refusing to take corporate money and are therefore refusing to be influenced by private lobbyists. One of the most prominent of this new wave of politicians is Minnesota Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. Nora Ericott tells us more.
When it comes to how they challenge U.S. imperialism, I think Omar has been much more explicit about having an anti-imperial critique than any of the other members of Congress.
I am beyond honored and excited for a president who will fight against Western imperialism and fight for a just world.
And I think that reflects her own personal history of being a refugee, of actually living in war, of being part of a refugee community upon arrival in the United States at a young age. And so that's why we see her in the beginning of her tenure be very, very, very forthright and assertive when it came to her questioning of Elliot Abrams for his role in mass killings sponsored by the United States.
Yes or no, do you think that massacre was a fabulous achievement that happened under our watch?
That is a ridiculous question. And I
yes or no?
No.
I will take that as a yes.
I am not going to respond to that kind of personal attack, which is not a question.
Yes or no, would you support an armed faction within Venezuela that engages in war crimes, crimes against humanity or genocide, if you believe they were serving U.S. interest, as you did in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua?
I am not going to respond to that question. I'm sorry.
I think it's that ability for Omar to be able to articulate a critique of the United States, its militarist rule abroad, beyond the Middle East. You know, it's the Middle East, it's the African continent, it's Central America, it's the Pacific, that she, you know, that really does set her apart and makes her unlike others who can come off sounding as American exceptionalists.
Omar's critique of U.S. imperialism fundamentally challenges the traditional exceptionalism that has dominated in both major parties for decades. It is representative of a shifting foreign policy discourse, both in Washington, D.C. and across the United States.
Caught in the midst of this shifting discourse has been the 2020 presidential election. As the commander-in-chief under Article 2 of the Constitution, the President of the United States plays a singularly important role as the arbiter of U.S. foreign policy. Under the 1973 War Powers Act, passed in the wake of the conflict in Vietnam, the president must receive congressional approval before committing troops to war, except in the instance of emergency situations, such as an attack upon the United States, its territories, possessions, or armed forces. In practice, however, the president often exercises a relatively free hand when it comes to foreign interventions. The last time the US Congress officially declared war was in 1942, against Bulgaria, Hungary, and Romania. Yet presidents engaged in clear acts of foreign aggression throughout the second half of the 20th century. For instance, Bill Clinton's 1999 NATO bombing campaign in Kosovo, undertaken without any prior consent of Congress.
The Kosovars have been victims of terrible atrocities. Their only hope was that the world would not turn away in the face of ethnic cleansing and killing, that the world would take a stand. We did for 78 days. Because we did, the Kosovars will go home.
The power of the president has been increased, particularly in the wake of 9/11. In 2001, Congress signed the authorization for use of military force against those responsible for the September 11th attacks. This declaration has been used by subsequent presidents as a legal justification to embark on a range of foreign exploits, such as the execution of Soleimani. The scale of the US military-industrial complex and the powerful role of the president in executing foreign policy means that attitudes towards the military economy should be a fundamental part of any presidential election.
Despite the shifting discourse critiquing U.S. interventionism, many of the Democratic candidates in the 2020 cycle followed the traditional line on foreign policy and the military economy. At the South Carolina debate, former mayor of New York City Michael Bloomberg detailed how his prospective foreign policy platform remained wedded to a traditional strategy of U.S. interventionism.
Mayor Bloomberg, voters have not heard much about your foreign policy views. Would you pull all combat troops out of the Middle East?
No. You want to cut it back as much as you can. But I think if we learn something from 9/11, people plan things overseas and execute them here. We have to be able to stop terrorism. And there's no guarantees that you're going to be able to do it. But we have to have some troops in places where terrorists congregate. And to not do so is just irresponsible.
Whilst less explicit, other candidates in the 2020 Democratic primary were no less embedded in the historical discourse of American exceptionalism. Before he dropped out of the race, former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg, repeatedly stressed his experience in the military as a qualification for the presidency.
Well, the first time I ever set foot in South Carolina, it was stepping off the bus that brought me to combat training near Fort Jackson. And that was to get ready to go to Afghanistan, where I saw that one of the things that kept me safe, just as sure as my body armor, was the fact that the flag on my shoulder represented a country that was known to keep its word. Our allies and our adversaries knew it.
In doing so, Buttigieg sought to play on the culturally embedded image of America as a leading force for democracy and liberation on the world stage. Fellow moderate Joe Biden uses similar rhetoric. Biden focuses on America as the country that can keep all others in line, leading by example and pressuring other nations. Here's the former vice president talking tough about how, under his presidency, America would stand up to dictators like China's Xi Jinping.
You can cooperate and you can also dictate exactly what they are. When, in fact, they said we're going to set up a no-fly zone, that you can't fly through our zone. He said, what do you expect me to do when I was over there? I said, we're going to fly right through it. We flew B-1 bombers through it. We got to make it clear. They must play by the rules.
Thank you, Mr.
Period,
President.
Period, period.
More often than not, when questioned on foreign policy, Biden seeks to position himself as the antithesis to the incumbent president. he typically uses Trump as a bar against which he can measure success, while not engaging with the growing movement of people pushing for a more extensive, systemic critique of U.S. military industry.
We believe in freedom of religion. That's why we'll end the Muslim ban. We believe in the power of free press. That's why I'll return immediately to daily press briefings in the White House. I'll reverse Trump's detrimental asylum policies. The Biden administration would immediately end the horrific practice of separating families at our borders.
Biden stresses foreign policy as a cornerstone of his run for office, emphasizing his dealings with world leaders during his time as vice president to Barack Obama. But his foreign policy, whilst in the Senate, has increasingly come under scrutiny. Just as Obama and then Trump criticized Clinton's hawkish interventionism, Biden has been repeatedly criticized over his support for the Iraq War by his rivals on the 2020 debate stage.
The war in Iraq turned out to be the worst foreign policy blunder in the modern history of this country. As Joe well knows, we lost 4,500 brave troops. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis died. We have spent trillions of dollars on that endless war, money which should go into healthcare and education and infrastructure in this country. Joe and I listened to what Dick Cheney and George Bush and Rumsfeld had to say. I thought they were lying. I didn't believe them for a moment. I took to the floor. I did everything I could to prevent that war. Joe saw it differently.
Bernie Sanders, and until recently Elizabeth Warren, made up the progressive contingent running to be the Democratic candidate in 2020. Like much of her platform, Warren's foreign policy sought to shine a light on special interest groups and their lobbying power in Washington. Warren made an explicit connection between American foreign policy and the domestic economy.
We need to refocus our international economic policies so that they benefit all Americans, not just wealthy elites. And at the same time, we must refocus our security policies by reining in unsustainable and ill-advised military commitments and adapt our strategies overseas for the new challenges we see in this coming century. And we need to end the fiction that our domestic and our foreign policies are somehow separate from each other, and recognize that policies that undermine working families in this country also erode America's strength in the world. In other words, it is time to create a foreign policy that works for all Americans, not just for the rich and powerful.
This rhetoric is not necessarily one of non-interventionism, but better interventionism. This focus on American strength and a foreign policy that works for all Americans does not mark a fundamental break with traditional exceptionalist rhetoric. In contrast, Senator Bernie Sanders is running a grassroots campaign which challenges the established narrative of the United States' role in the world.
Occasionally, it might be a good idea to be honest about American foreign policy, and that includes the fact that America has overthrown governments all over the world, in Chile, in Guatemala, in Iran, and when dictatorships, whether it is the Chinese or the Cubans, do something good, you acknowledge that.
This articulates a radical break with the status quo discourse on American foreign policy. Sanders' critique challenges a historical assumption core to bipartisan American politics, that exceptionalist rhetoric is necessary for political survival.
I'll tell you what I think the answer is. You know, and I got to say this, you know, it is politician, a president gets up there, we're going to be tough, and these are evil guys, we're going to go to war, wow, and your poll ratings go up. And then people say, well, wait a minute, you know, what are the unintended consequences of that? Well, how many people are going to die? How much is it going to cost us? Oh, candidate X or Congressman X is soft on terror. 30-second ad, Congressman, you know, X, he doesn't want to protect America. All right? And I really get very angry at that approach. Because we sit in the Congress in our beautiful rooms, beautiful studio over here, and we do not know what war is about.
We asked campaign co-chair Ro Khanna and state senator for Ohio and surrogate of the Sanders campaign, Nina Turner, what a Sanders foreign policy might look like.
Senator Sanders understands that you have to bring the world leaders together, that we rise or fall, not internally as a nation, but as citizens of the world.
Under Bernie Sanders, we will have no more unconstitutional wars. He and I worked together to help stop the war in Yemen. We passed an amendment to stop any funding for a war in Iran. He has led on opposing support for military regimes in Latin America. Bernie Sanders will have a foreign policy based on restraint and human rights and engagement to tackle climate change.
The same themes are evident throughout Sanders' political career, whether it's his unpopular vote against the Iraq War. His work to prevent the Saudi-led bombing in Yemen.
Today, we in the Senate have the opportunity to take a major step forward in ending the horrific war in Yemen.
Or his condemnation of the Israeli government's occupation of Palestine.
But what I happen to believe is that right now, sadly, tragically, in Israel, through Bibi Netanyahu, you have a reactionary racist who is now running that country. And I happen to believe that what our foreign policy in the Mideast should be about is absolutely protecting the independence and security of Israel. But you cannot ignore the suffering of the Palestinian people.
These are tangible examples of how Sanders has challenged the dominant narrative, which upholds a for-profit military-industrial complex reliant on interventionism. Sanders is campaigning on a platform that not only seeks to cut back on military expenditure and rein in the role of private contractors, but redeploy those resources elsewhere. Tejasvi Nagaraja outlines why he believes that a structural readjustment of the economy is necessary for a prosperous future.
When we come up against the annual budget, right, and when we come up against budgeting in Congress, it is necessary both for dollars and cents, as well as for shifting the ideological paradigm to make cuts in the defense budget in order to expand funding for the types of things that we would like to see, like Medicare for all, like a Green New Deal. So they will have to face that guns versus butter logic that we have that says, first of all, that I'm not endangering national security by advocating these healthcare expansions or these jobs expansions. But at the same time, that it's necessary to make these cuts, that we are offensively, intentionally changing the U.S. economy and transitioning the U.S. economy for prosperity. And we see these discussions around climate, you know, where we have to shift the narrative. And with the Green New Deal, activists are trying to shift that narrative to not say, you know, we are moralists who want to get rid of coal and oil because, you know, we know smart things and you'll have to deal with it. And we look forward to eliminating jobs. But actually, we have a vision that this is not the future. And some of those advocates are even invoking FDR's drive to World War II and saying that the Green New Deal has to have that urgency. We face an existential crisis. Climate change is like fascism and is bound up in rising authoritarianism. We have to get ahead of this and transform the economy for the good.
Nagaraja believes that it's not just important to focus on where material resources should be allocated, but how we discuss and plan this transition.
What progressive politicians and left politicians will have to do is come up with models where they build trust with local communities, with local elected officials, with local businesses, if that's part of it, but with local voters and workers who work in military industrial entities, who work in companies that are contracted with the Pentagon, whose paychecks are subsidized by the NDAA, the defense budget, and with the military itself, with military bases and service members and base communities, where not only service members, but many other people are employed adjacent to those base communities, and build trust and say, this is not the future. Your economy is not the future. And sectors of the economy collapse or decline all the time. It happens all the time. It happens for market reasons, and we let that happen. We're going to make also some political decisions to have sectors of the economy decline because they're not sustainable, and we will transition those to other things. And that can be a tremendous alternative if it's bound up in something like this Green New Deal agenda.
Faced with an impending climate catastrophe, many believe that this Green New Deal economy provides the perfect object around which to orient this refocusing of resources. On the second part of our series on the US election, we speak to leading figures at the forefront of the movement, demanding bold climate policy in the context of the 2020 election.
Thank you for listening to this Our Voices podcast from Open Democracy. If you enjoyed this podcast and would encourage others to listen, why not head to iTunes, subscribe, and leave us a review? Open Democracy is an independent global media platform that is only possible because of your kind donations. To find out more or to make a donation, head to opendemocracy.net.